Hey, what's up? You're with Taking It Down. We're one of the podcasts from the Alabama Take. You can find the family of podcasts there or in any podcast app. And if you'd like to write or produce podcasts in conjunction with the website, reach out. We are eager to hear pitches and ideas. Find us on social media or email us at thealabamatake@gmail.com. Today, as always, almost always, we've got our co-host Adam Morrow here sitting down with us and playing third fiddle for the first half of the show is going to be Donovan Reinwald on the show. If you don't know already, we're going to be talking normal people in the first half. That's our major first half segment. And then in the back half of the show, we're going to be talking about the end of The Last Dance, which, that's wrapped. That's done. So, well, let's start taking some things down, shall we? Gentlemen, Donovan, Adam, you've both said your tanks.
Thanks,
yeah.
Sure.
Just to let listeners know, we're doing this whole episode in horrible Irish accents.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I can only say three things. So.
Yeah, me too. Brilliant.
So I think here's the big question for y'all. Subtitles on or off?
No.
Off. No subtitles?
Off for me. Off.
This one was...
I would have been tempted to turn them on. Natalie is lagging behind. I finally hit the point where I was like, I gotta keep watching, you know? I was like, is this going to bug you? And she's like, no, she goes to bed or whatever, and I keep watching. Maybe as I'm watching again with her, I'll ask her if she wants subtitles on. There's probably a few, especially early on, where they're flying pretty fast.
Yeah.
And more kind of out in the country and kind of exaggerating it. Maybe it would have been helpful. I don't know.
There's a little bit for me, subtitles went on at the beginning. Probably didn't need them. They're speaking slowly enough. Mm-hmm. But like some of these, like, so I watched... The other Irish show I've watched, which was Dairy Girls, cannot understand what they're saying sometimes without the subtitles. So,
but you know when to laugh.
Yeah, I wish the nation of Ireland would get on this though. Like they need to, if they want to have an international audience, maybe they could start to speak like Americans,
enunciate a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Quit being so charming.
But they are very. So before we get into dissecting the back half of normal people, which is what we plan on doing, I just want to do a general check-in. We tend to do this in the last few episodes just to go around the room and say, well, what's going on? How are we doing? Pop culturally speaking or beyond. So Adam, what's up, man?
I'm doing pretty good, hanging in there. You know, we talked last week a bit about the feeling that we had all the time in the world during this quarantine. Like the flip side of the anxiety was, oh, we'll watch a movie every night and a few television programs, and now that time has disappeared. Well, mm-hmm. It has not slowed down in the last 7 days. That kind of feels like normal life, and normal life is kind of getting resumed here in Alabama. But I'm staying at the house. I'm consuming some media. We started the Hulu program, The Great.
Right. That's pretty good. As did I. I want to get into that with you in the back half, maybe.
Okay.
Very briefly. We'll because I've only watched one episode. There's just one point I want to make, but we'll save it for the back half.
I'll tell you the other thing that I've taken up.
Yeah.
And this was at the urging of Parker McAnally, who plays bass in Speckled Bird with us and is a crucial member of the Prescriptions, that Nashville-based band. He sent me this podcast and said, you got to check this out. And it's called Wind of Change. And I devoured the first two episodes and can't wait to listen to more. So if we're doing our roundup on what we've been consuming, that's a good one. That's a real good one. Highly recommended.
You had messaged me about that earlier today, and I might give it a whirl. Finding time for things can be tricky. It sounds so ridiculous to say, even though we're kind of stuck at home in quotation marks. But yeah, Donovan, what's been going on, man, up there in UConn?
We have had gorgeous weather for the past weekend. So out walking in the woods, looking for stone walls. Somebody's out in my woods making true detective style teepees or something out there. So it's pretty terrifying. If you don't hear from me, assume I've been murdered by cultists.
Well, whenever you post these things on your Instagram, I always think you're in Blair Witch.
It was feeling like that a little bit. Been watching some movies, revisited. My wife had a DVD player that she bought that was region free that would It's the worst DVD player. It just would skip all the time. I finally lost my mind during quarantine. I was like, I can't do this anymore. Ordered a Blu-ray player. Broke it in by watching an old DVD of the Royal Tenenbaums. Hadn't watched that for a while.
There it is.
There we go.
Like a warm blanket.
It was incredible. Reading a... looking at my books, right, trying to think, like, the stuff I've had on my shelf for forever, might as well knock it out. So I'm reading The Spy Who Came In From the Cold for the first time.
Who wrote that?
Le Carre, Jean Le Carre.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And cool. In the podcast realm, I'm listening to a podcast about Byzantine history. There's 212 episodes so far. I'm at about 45. It's great.
You've made it 45 episodes into a 212 episode history of the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, they're only like half an hour. They're good.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. It's not an hour would be too much. It's pretty interesting stuff.
What does 212 episodes translate to in Simpson seasons?
Well, what Simpson seasons did they go on the Crusades? Because that's where they are in the history.
Only about 10, season six, 10 seasons.
That's season 10.
Yeah, I think so. 10, right? Divide 22 by. Yeah.
Okay. There you go.
But there's never been a more Donovan statement than he's listening to that history podcast, right?
Oh, what a nerd!
It's great.
No, that sounds way more in depth than I did the hardcore history about World War I last year, and
yeah,
love that. But those are can be 3 hour episodes.
Yeah,
half hour is much more digestible.
Even though I'm about 40 in. It's really only been about, starts around 474, whenever, you know, Ravenna falls to the Visigoths. So you're really only about 100 years, a little bit over 100 years past.
Julian. I don't know if you're selling me on this or disappointing me based on that statement.
I'm running away from this. So, Adam, really quick, you and I will. I want to hear your comment on. You and I both watched the first episode of HBO's I Know This Much Is True. We're not going to get in and dissect it. I'm just curious what you thought of that very first episode.
I have a story about this.
Okay, fire away, and then Adam will maybe Adam and I will give our thoughts on that first episode.
Yeah.
Wally Lamb, who wrote it, lives on the road on my way to work. I know where his house is. And so one of our friends, Matt Jones, who is now teaching in New Jersey, he's got his PhD, he's teaching in New Jersey, was Wally's personal assistant. And he's sort of like a rake, right? He's sort of a man about town. Like, he just knows everybody. So we get word that Mark Ruffalo and Wally Lamb and the director, he's the guy that did Blue Valentine and he did a couple of other things. Mm-hmm. They're at a breakfast place in Willimantic, where I live. So they're having breakfast there. And we're like, haha, this is so cool. You know, because they're scouting for this movie, right? Or for this TV show. Because Wally is with all of them and he's showing them the area, right, that he based it on. And we're joking and we're like, I wonder if Matt Jones met Mark Ruffalo yet. One of our friends texts him. And we get back a picture, and there's Matt Jones arm in arm with Mark Ruffalo.
Amazing.
That is great.
You know, I kept my eyes peeled for a, I don't know if you answered the call to be an extra somehow in this, because it seemed like it was happening in your neighborhood.
It is happening literally in my neighborhood.
Amazing.
We've actually reached out to Mark Ruffalo in this podcast, and that is not a joke at all. We've reached out
maybe. Grease the wheels with your friend.
I'll do what I can.
We wanted to see if he wanted to come on and talk about the show. So
what else is he doing? He can't fly across the country and have breakfast in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I guess great.
That place now has the breakfast place, which is actually called That Breakfast Place. They've got pictures of Mark Ruffalo with the entire staff there. It's incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Has Guy Fieri been there or just Mark?
No, but Mark Ruffalo has.
Okay, cool.
That's all I need. So first episode of the HBO show, I Know This Much Is True, aired. Two episodes have actually aired at this point of our podcast, but we've only watched the one. So, Adam, what did you think? Because I had a couple of minor thoughts.
I think my first impression was I had a friend, an older friend, who when I was doing a lot of rock climbing and outdoor adventuring and that kind of thing, you know, he had types of fun. So he would say type one fun is it's a blast while you're doing it. You love remembering it later. Remember that camping trip we took? That was a great time, like that kind of thing. Type two is when you're on the trip and a thunderstorm breaks out and you have zero fun while it's going on. But later you're like, that's a good story. And now I earned that story and I learned something about myself having this type 2 fun. Type 3 fun is where it just sucks and you do not enjoy it later. You don't think back and think, oh, I'm glad I went through that. And so he had these three types of fun. So to me, watching this was squarely type 2 fun. Like it felt like it's a
tough hang, right?
Emotional, but not, I'm going to use the word slog. It felt like a slog, but it was emotional. It wasn't anything to do with the quality of the program or anything. It's just tackling a super heavy subject that just beat the crap out of you for an hour. You know, I pulled it up because I thought here's a trailer that has Beach House in it. I have to, like, contractually, I have to watch this as like an indie rock person who adores that band. So, I'm in now, but man, it was just brutal. I say all that to say it was brutal to watch.
It was. And you know, Ruffalo's playing he's playing twins. So he's doing both characters, and one of which is, has some mental health issues, some major mental health issues, and the other brother is trying to keep it all together. And it is based on the Wally Lamb novel, but hence Donovan's story, but it's a tough hang, but you know what? It's so well acted. It ventures perhaps maybe into that misery porn kind of, where you just can't help but just watch it. Like, Jesus, how dark and gloomy is this going to get? But the way it's well made and well produced, and of course well acted. So I'm excited to see that in as excited as you can get on that kind of show.
Yeah, I think it's going to be one. You know, Plot Against America was one that I didn't rush to when it came out. Like, I would give it a few days and kind of steel myself to watch it because it felt so poignant, especially as the quarantine was starting up and divisions are so strong. This is another one, a different kind of thing where, like, you got to be in the right zone to take. It's not going to be like, oh, I got a spare hour, I'm going to just cram this one in. I don't think so. It's going to be a little bit more. I'm in. I'm going to keep watching, but it was kind of rough.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed 100%. And I love that type 3. But isn't that type 3 of fun just not fun at all? Isn't that like...
Yeah, it's not fun. You don't want to do it. You don't want to watch it again. You don't want to go there again, whatever it is.
You don't even want to talk about it afterward.
Nah. I mean, maybe it's like to prove that you have out-suffered someone else, but that's about it.
All right. Well, there we go. We may talk about, I know this much is true, in the future weeks. So there you go, people. But we are here to really, especially with Donovan here with us, we're going to dive into Normal People on Hulu. We're talking the back half of that. We've covered it a lot in the past few weeks. The middle section we covered, now it's the last 4 or 5 episodes is what we want to talk about, starting with maybe episode 8. And if you're like me, you watched these a while ago because I just ended up consuming them. Once episode 8 hit, it was just like, I can't stop hanging with these two people. The focus is strictly on Connell and Marianne, of course. And I didn't want to leave them alone. I was scared something would happen to them when I was gone. So let's talk about episode 8 briefly, and this will bleed into 9 and 10. We'll be jumping around a little. So if you haven't watched episode 8 and beyond of Normal People, pause, go watch, come back. Okay. Episode 8 is the Italy episode. So there you go, people.
You said you didn't want to leave him alone because you didn't know what was going to happen. You know exactly what's going to happen if you leave those two alone for any length of time.
Absolutely.
There's no question about that.
They're like guinea pigs.
Yeah, they are.
They just can't help it.
Blaine, I'm right there with you. Once they, to me, the turning point of like how quickly I wanted to binge this show happened when they have the misunderstanding and the breakup.
Oh, man.
Pretty much from that point forward, it was breakneck pace for me. Something about the back half of the season, I just couldn't stop watching.
That's almost exactly how I was telling Blaine. I felt like I was real, you know, coming into this show, I was pretty high on it. I liked it. But it just kind of the back half was almost unputdownable. I was almost like cringe watching it too. Maybe that's not quite right, but just like waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? Because these actors are so good at like seeming really comfortable together and, you know, like they play people who enjoy each other's company and then some pretty really well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're just kind of like, oh man, what's going to happen now?
As in like that that can't endure. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, right. Like you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? Like anytime they're happy, it's like, whoa, it's going to ruin it.
Yeah. And then with episode 8, on top of the acting, it's a well-made show. Episode 8 may have had some of the best shots in cinematography since like Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad.
I thought easily. There was some, when they're taking their trip into town and all, it was kind of, it's probably a too tenuous connection, but I just kept thinking of the Roberto Rossellini film, Voyage to Italy, the whole time, because, it takes place in an Italian villa, right? It's about an English couple. It's Ingrid Bergman, and I don't remember who.
I heard a lot of comparisons to Call Me By Your Name as well.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that.
A lot of the shots were reminiscent of that movie.
Very kind of sun-drenched, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was so stunning at moments, the cinematography, that I texted Blaine like mid-episode, which I usually, with this one, I kind of put the phone down, but I knew that he had already seen it. I was like, I cannot believe how good this looks.
You know, the shot, and I'm going to jump ahead a half a bit, but it was just what I just thought was gorgeous was actually the concluding shot of episode 9 when she's in Sweden. She's walking out. Yep. And it's just snow and they don't do a song at the end.
Yeah.
It's just her walking.
This is the other time I texted Blaine that I had like a physical reaction to that because my Hulu usually pops up immediately and says, press this button to like skip ahead to the next episode. And it didn't do it. And I was like, have I lost count? Cause it was like, it was getting later at night. It's like, have I lost count of how many of these I've watched? Is this the end? Cause it could have been the end. It totally could have been the end of the season.
Yeah. Well, and when you compare that to the actual end, not a lot of difference.
No, not at all. But
that was the first time they didn't cut to black.
Right.
And they just let it sit on that horizon.
I think there was something about like letting it sit with where Marianne was that just like, that was the shot. I couldn't stop thinking about that.
Yeah.
Like the way that shot created that feeling.
And this show did visual storytelling. You know, you hear over and over that movies and TV are a visual medium. And Matt just used the shot and paired it with what you're talking about, what Marianne is mentally. And it's damn near devastating shot of that horizon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Devastating is definitely the word for that ending when she's reading that email.
Yep.
Or it's Connell's voice in her head.
Connell's voice. Yeah.
It's just incredible. Also, just an aside from the production standpoint, they shot all that Sweden stuff in February of this year, which is just a mind-boggling turnaround time on making it fit with everything else and making it fit so well. I mean, that in just a few months is not a long time in the production world.
You can tell too. I mean, that's amazing, but that kind of made me think too. It is kind of neat that the show obviously decided that, no, we're actually going to go to Italy and shoot. And no, we're actually going to go to Sweden and shoot.
Yeah.
It kind of helps it feel more than quote unquote, just a TV show. Clearly BBC's cashing those Hulu checks.
Well, it does have that cinematic film kind of quality.
Well, you know, sometimes some of these BBC shows can kind of feel like, I don't know what to compare this to, except like maybe something on the CW back when it's like, going to wherever, but it's Vancouver. You know, it's like always Toronto.
Right. Totally.
Let me ask you guys a question. How great were just the small moments of this show? There's an example, I think it is in episode 9 when she's in Sweden, where she's just pouring water down the drain and the camera lingers on the drain, you know, talking about these shot, and there's just something that's simplistic. It's not a beautiful horizon. It's not a sunset. It's just water going down the drain, but it is much longer than your average television or some movies would stay on that kitchen sink.
Yeah, there's it kind of parallels a scene in episode 11 when Connell has a tall boy of beer and takes a few sips and then pours the whole thing down the drain. And it's not.
Yep.
They don't cut away as if to imply, and then he poured the beer out. Next scene, it lingers on that pour for the entire can. And when you're doing a mini series, it's 12 episodes, and every second is precious. You know, you almost think of it like a short story, like every word is precious. That kind of thought process. That's a long time to dedicate. to that scene.
Especially, you know, they're 30 minutes or less. You're exactly right.
Yeah, some of them are really 22, 21 minutes. Mm-hmm. I was thinking so many of those small moments, mm-hmm. they really trust their actors to nail them. Like, I think that that's kind of what really makes them. Like, there's so many bits where the camera will just kind of linger on their faces, mm-hmm. usually as they're sort of in a pensive moment. And, you know, they're kind of like Adam said, right? Like, every moment is precious. So if you don't trust your actors to carry it, you're going to just cut to the next scene and you're going to keep the plot essentially moving so that you don't really care, right? Like, you don't miss that. And doing the opposite, I think, was really powerful, right? Because it kind of gets that, you almost get like a familiarity with the way the actors play their characters, mm-hmm. right? And you get a familiarity with their faces, and but you also kind of have that, I think especially both of them were really pretty good about this, where you kind of have that, like, what are they thinking right now? I think the woman who plays Marianne was very good at, she to me was kind of almost a little bit more mysterious than Connell. Just in the sense of, she almost, what is she thinking? And I think a lot of times she maybe doesn't know her own self. But I think she did a really good job of just, there's one moment I'm thinking of in particular, which isn't even that long of a scene, but it's old last episode, I think, where there's kind of a shot of Marianne in a rearview mirror, and she asks Lorraine what people think of her mother.
Yeah.
Right. And Lorraine answers, and they cut back to Marianne, and she just kind of goes, huh. And they just kind of let the camera be on her for maybe half a second or a second or two more. And you're just kind of like, what is she thinking right now? And you're really not sure. And the actor just has to carry it.
And I wonder if there's
really cool
if they do that because her background, Connell doesn't try to hide the fact that he's, or at least he's very poor at hiding the fact that he's uncomfortable or doesn't know what to say or whatever. But she comes from such a complex minefield of a home life that maybe like putting on a face is something that she's more used to having to do.
Absolutely. Kind
of
like
survive scenes. I don't know. There's so many layers of, you know, I've been selling people on the show or attempting to, and we've said this, but this is one of the first times that I wonder how someone accomplished something in a book that I saw on the screen. Usually it's the opposite. You know, like, how are you going to pull that off?
Yes.
From the page? But
I was just going to say that the book is really an internal thing, and it's an internal piece of writing, and it's very, Sally Rooney does this distance thing as a narrator. You're very much inside of what's happening with them, but at the same time, at a certain remove, it's you would think that would land flat on the page, but it doesn't.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I was just floored by the whole thing.
And before we get fully away from the Italy stuff, Adam, yeah, you yeah. found that exact place, right? You want to say that?
Well, yeah. Somebody posted, as I do with all things, Reddit is consulted at some point. And someone posted that you can, through Airbnb, rent the house, the villa that they were in, for a cool $40-something a night right now, thanks to our friend COVID. So if we want to take across the ocean.
Do live broadcast?
Maybe
yeah.
Now is the time. I mean, you know, there's some risk, but what? No risk, no reward, right?
Maybe. So I think it's around episode 11, 10 and 11, where I started to realize that, and Adam mentioned this to me off mic, I hate to keep saying that kind of stuff, but yeah, he did. Maybe Helen was just as good for Connell as Marianne, if not better. This is where he has the girlfriend who is a med student, and she seems absolutely fine, seems to treat him well. He treats her well for the most part, other than slipping up and hanging out with Marianne when he probably shouldn't.
It's tough. It's because she's really the factor in, I guess, episode 9 and 10, right? 9 being kind of Marianne's episode when they're away from each other for this extended period, and 10 being his episode when his friend commits suicide and he goes through this really dark season. To me, those are the two best episodes of the whole series. I mean, they're narratively the richest for sure. And sometimes I hesitate to pick those because it's kind of easy to tee off on like a big moment like that. But they just knocked it out of the park. And I totally agree that I hated to see Helen go. I mean, Helen was good for him. I don't think that he was emotionally present for her even before the suicide, but I don't know. I was rooting for that relationship. It seemed like the moment when at least Connell realizes the things that he learned from the relationship with Marianne and could carry forward with him if they had accepted that they weren't supposed to be together.
I was going to say pretty much the exact same thing about with Helen. It was almost kind of rough to watch because exactly what Adam's, it seems like part of the whole show really was almost Connell kind of learning or committing to like sharing parts of himself. Like it seemed like he kept a lot of himself really just for himself. You know, like, and he's with groups of friends, but he's really kind of like, he'll joke and laugh, but he's also kind of like the guy that just watches, right?
He's always like the observer. Even when he's the center of the attention, he's still observing.
Yep. And he's often, I mean, he'll share things that he thinks, but he's often bouncing off and responding to other people, right? You know, it was great to see Hell, right? Like everything's great and happy, but also you could see too that he's holding parts of himself back from her. Right. And maybe even giving those to Marianne, even though he's in a relationship with Helen. So it was rough to see.
It was a good foil to all of Marianne's just abysmally terrible choices of boyfriends. I mean, three in a row. I mean, you could debate the merits of each one. Obviously, the first two are terrible. Maybe the third one, I don't know what his deal was. Maybe he was a decent dude that just indulged her fantasies too far.
Yeah.
I don't know. That gets into a real complex area, but
the show has taken criticism almost only about that BDSM stuff.
Watching that, I just in my brain, I was like, man, I bet if I check Twitter, there's going to be folks with things to say about that.
Takes.
I thought it was right. It was kind of interesting too. Like Marianne, even a couple times too, she mentioned, you know, she's acquainted with feminist thought and theory, but she falls into roles where she is kind of owned by men. And you kind of note with like Jamie and the first boyfriend who, you know, the debating guy, there's actually almost two identical scenes where she stays home and cleans and they go out.
Yeah.
And you know,
Connell, well, and also Connell is involved in both of those, right?
Yeah. And it was kind of, you know, kind of interesting too, right? Like somebody, it was either you or Blaine Adam, I'm sorry, I don't remember, but like what is kind of Marianne's journey maybe is almost like what kind of like life am I expected to lead and where am I supposed to fit into it?
Yeah.
And how do I do that?
It's also complicated. We don't have to go down this rabbit hole, but at least three times that I can remember, she tells Connell when they're having their intimate moments, like, you could do whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
And like that impulse is there for her. And so there's an element where it's like, in 2020, are we supposed to shame that in any way, or can she own it? But it also seems very on the nose and like tied to her upbringing in a way that's a little simplistic. I don't know.
Yeah. I think even in the first episode, right, they go to the, is it the ghost house or whatever it is?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, I could lie down right here and you could do whatever you want.
Yep.
And Connell has kind of, you know, right. So it's kind of like, I think there's bits where maybe you're almost more frustrated at Connell and you think, has Marianne done more for Connell than Connell's done for Marianne? But kind of Connell's been the drumbeat of like, do what you want to do.
Yeah. There's also a theme of people that you really want Connell to hit in the face.
Yeah, absolutely. About
like what he's done for her when he's risen to her defense. And I don't know, there's an enormous amount of restraint that he shows against Jamie in Italy that, I mean, that dude was just from daily. Blaine, you mentioned this, you know, he chooses, or he tells Marianne what wine she wants in an earlier episode, and like that, making decisions for her. And he's just a total prick through this whole episode.
He's the worst guy from square one.
Yeah.
And that was long before he was dating her. He started doing that.
And he's clearly got his eye on her. And he ask, I think multiple times, like, is Connell smart?
Yes.
And he does not like that he's much smarter than he is, you know, and much more capable, all these things. But I guess you were saying what has Connell done for her? It's also mirrored in that, you know, he seems to know there that Jamie is not the guy to punch in the face, much yep. as I wanted him to. Instead, yep. he directs no anger towards him, except for, like, kind of playing with him a little bit at dinner in this detached way, but he only comforts her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was an interesting bit, right? When she screams and he runs into the house.
Right.
And Jamie smashes a glass. You almost are like, oh man, is he going to punch Jamie? But in fact, it's Marianne that he stops from attacking Jamie.
Pays almost no attention to Jamie.
He directs her away.
The foe is never really paid much mind until the end when he finally lets her brother have it.
Yeah. That was almost the only thing, just with her brother. First off, every time he came in it was like, oh, this butthole again.
Yeah.
But also small knock on the, I almost never was, you know, that I guess there's stuff with like, he's jealous of her or whatever, but he almost felt like almost the only like two dimensional character in it. Like it's yeah. Okay. I get it. Like he hates her.
Yeah.
And that's it. That could have been more fully.
I agree that, you know, you're shown elements of his life, maybe not working out the same way.
Yeah.
not as rich as hers. And he's kind of just got this job that he doesn't care about. And
that's probably bound to happen when your point of view character, when you only limit your point of view characters to one or two people.
Plus on top of that, I think it's probably about your storytelling choices too. Right. And how much time do you really want to spend there?
Yeah.
We don't need a ton to know that, like,
just villainize him basically.
Yeah. Like Marianne has a deeply unhappy home life, right? Like that's fine.
Yeah.
When they did like the Christmas scene, which is a direct counterpoint to, you know, when Marianne goes home and is having, all I could think of was like the bit from Annie Hall when Woody Allen's like meeting his girlfriend's waspy family versus his own family.
Yeah.
Just like, so now that we've kind of danced around this question, but I think it's one of the most important one, surviving side characters, let's rank them. Niall, he's up there. Joanna, mm-hmm. great. She's up there.
Mm-hmm. They did that whole thing of like whittling down the social structure so well. Like there's this big group at the beginning of, as they say, first year. You know, they even, when they're walking up the stairs in that later episode, what would our first year selves think of us now? And it's, they live much quieter lives, and which is probably generally reflected in people's college years. But I don't know. I'm with you. Those are the two roommates really came out shining.
Tell you what, I wasn't sure about Niall, and then here he is, man. He's Connell. He's the best friend Connell ever had. Recommending he go talk to someone. Yeah, he's supportive.
Really saved Connell there with that.
Niall's a champ. Yeah,
I really do. Donovan, you almost touched on this with something earlier, but I do think that one of the most interesting questions the show proposes was just what do we owe people who shape us immensely?
Yeah.
What do we owe these or anything at all?
I thought that when that comes up and Connell says some version of like, all of this is happening because of you, like in a grateful way, not in a, you caused all of this, but that moment of reflection, she doesn't say, no, you were great all along. She says, yeah, you're right. But, and then says like, I also, there's a, recognition of codependence in a positive way. Like they grew together mm-hmm. that happened
yeah.
in that moment that, I don't know. I thought that was really well done and it kind of flipped that moment on its head when she just owns it and says, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I thought, you know, it was kind of going off of what Adam said. I wouldn't say that the ending was happy, right, in a traditional way. So much as, you know, I wouldn't say like that was a happy ending. So much as I would say like that was a hopeful ending.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because like they're still so young, right? Like we don't know, they don't know what their lives are going to be. But just when Marianne was like, we have helped each other in so many ways, and also, you know, it was kind of, Blaine, you said, what do we owe to each other? I think for the first time, I love the bit where Marianne was like, it's my life and I'm learning how to live it. And it was like that moment where Marianne, I mean, I think she realized too that like what she owed to herself and that it was okay for her to say, no, I'm not going to follow you to New York. I don't want to. And that she didn't owe so much to Connell to be his slave, right? But she could have her own life and learn how to live it, which just devastating, man. That ending was just very, very strong.
That's also a moment of humility from her, kind of the flip of him being embarrassed of her in high school and then early on in college, her being embarrassed of him. And then that's a recognition that she maybe, they're thinking of Dublin as kind of a smaller life compared to New York, and that's what she needs to do. She needs to learn this mode of living that she's getting a little bit better at, but he has eclipsed her in some ways and needs to move on to something else.
Yeah, right. Because it's exactly what you said, right? Like the girl, the first year girl who was sort of trying to throw her own salons, right? Where everyone sits around and drinks, right? Like that she doesn't have to do that anymore.
Right.
And maybe he can go do that, right? Yeah. He can live some other life.
I took it totally as I wanted to know what was going to happen, but if they had ended the show when she went to Sweden, it would have had a similar timbre in a way. So I don't know, it seemed like just there are more chapters that are not to be known in their story, obviously, because like you said, they're still so young.
Which brings up the question, Hulu's really pushing for a second season, and I am, this is one of those shows that does not need a second season.
Nope. That was, if we get one, great, that's fine, but if it ends right there, it ends right there. And that was a great ending.
I would totally watch the second season, but it...
Oh, yeah. Oh, same.
It could end there. I think it's so... I thought about this. Funny that there's a certain perception of the show as like a great romantic movie, which would be the first time that we've discussed anything of that ilk on the podcast. I think that's generally not what we go in for, but it has just totally transcended that. Like if you get on social media, there's like a whole account on Instagram about the chain that Connell wears. The girls are finding this very attractive, I guess.
Yeah, and his sex chain.
There's like a whole other way of reading this show that, I don't know, that's just so interesting to me that, obviously there's so much substance there between the source text and especially the acting. If you guys haven't seen the James Corden bit where he has them both on and has them reenact TV scenes, Donovan, have you seen this?
I have not seen this. I'm going to instantly look it up.
He plays, everyone, if you're into the show, needs to look this up. He plays them a clip of a random program. I'll spoil it for you. The first one is Guy Fieri and sends them a script and they have to read it in the timbre of the show, in the tone of the show. It's good stuff. But so obviously there's just a lot of heavy lifting going on with that skill and that source text. And I don't know, it just transcends maybe like surface level. I would not be into the show, but it's just so good.
I feel that if you had walked up to me and just laid it out, I'd be like, it's probably good. I don't know if it's for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The emotional impact this show had on me, I could only compare it to when I was 14 or 15 and watched My So-Called Life. So it does have that why feel to it at times that where it hits you in that nostalgic heart where that's hidden in you.
It did that one indulgent thing where they kiss at the bar on New Year's in front of all of the high school friends that they had tried to hide from.
Yep.
And it flashed back to the first time they kissed. And I was like, oh, man, feelings.
Right. And, yeah, it's kind of that teenage yearning thing, right? And,
exactly. And, yeah.
So there's one thing from the penultimate episode that was not resolved and it is still making me very nervous. There's a bit
please be the thing that I'm thinking about.
There's a bit in Connell's bedroom where they put a pop on the floor.
The Chekhov's popsicle.
Yes, and they never pick it up, and that popsicle is just—it's hot in there. It's melting on the floor. They're gonna get ants.
I wish that I could describe the anxiety that I felt. I could not stop thinking about the one that she put on the floor.
That was like stressing
the
entire me out. Time
they were on the bed. I could not stop thinking about.
It's like that thing's melted.
Something's gonna happen. They're gonna step
you're,
in it. Her foot.
You're gonna have to clean that up.
It's gonna be terrible.
That's the same kind of anxiety I have in a show when they walk into a room and they pour themselves a drink and then they set it down and never drink it. I get so anxious. I'm like, why did you pour the drink? You're wasting the drink. Whatever the drink is, if it's whiskey or a water or whatever.
God forbid, a coffee.
Oof. Yeah.
Don't do it.
I'd also like to mention a great scene immediately preceding that, which I've seared into my mind, which is Connell at the ice cream truck and then behind him, like he's like 6'4" or right. whatever he is.
A row of children.
Just a row of little children right behind him. It's great.
That's a great scene.
And that might be the happiest we can end on with this particular show. So, Donovan, thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, sure. Thanks. Yeah. Change so, is brilliant.
We want to thank Donovan for joining us. And this will lead us to our break on the other side. We're going to talk. We're going to talk about The Last Dance for the most part, so stick around. Okay, it's our mid-show break. Don't forget that we have plenty of musings over on the website, thealabamatake.com. You can contact us at thealabamatake@gmail. The major podcast that started it all is on hiatus. It's called The Alabama Take, but that'll give you time to play catch-up on those two seasons that have aired. They're eager and waiting, so join Corey Hannah, the host of that show, and from any podcast provider that you prefer, should be easy to find. It's called The Alabama Take, and click on the website. But we're going to get back into it. Okay, Adam, it's just you and I left.
We've been whittled down. Two remain.
I've got two shows I'm going to just toss at you, and you give me Twitter length responses.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm joking. You, of course, you go beyond that.
But, are we talking original Twitter or the new expanded character length?
Expanded.
Okay. I think I can do that.
So did you happen to watch the most recent episode of Run on HBO?
I'll even give you the circumstance that I watched it in. So far, this program has been pretty breezy. You know, I mean, it's obviously dealing with some weighty stuff, leaving poor Harry Crane out on the vine out there in California while she runs off with, you know, the dashing. What is that actor's name?
Donald Gleason.
Yeah. Ron Weasley's older brother is how I always think of him. But so up until now, those have been the stakes, you know, real life stuff. But kind of, if you're just going to sit down and with dinner and watch a 30-minute program, maybe this is kind of one that isn't going to totally ruin your day or engage your mind, whatever. Mm-hmm. Until this week, my anxiety levels went through the roof. If you've not seen this most recent one, well, I guess now will be, this is last week's most recent since this will come out tomorrow and it airs tonight, but the stakes have been dramatically raised with the death of his assistant. All of a sudden, they're fleeing a potential murder scene, if not a manslaughter scene, or at least something that you're not supposed to run away from.
And on top of that, she left her phone there by accident.
I mean, I had my hands on my face when all this was happening. Like, what is going on? It's a credit to the two actors that I'm so involved because it's, you know, it's kind of a goofy storyline, but I was just all in when that went down.
Me too.
I had the Amtrak website pulled up and thinking, oh, maybe train travel. Maybe there's segments where it doesn't suck in the country. Maybe I should look into this. And then all of a sudden, blood. I mean, it escalated so quickly.
I think the train travel could still work as long as you don't jump off and run to a farmhouse and
over
millions of dollars.
Yeah. Well, I don't have millions of dollars to get too upset about, so that works out. That's the other, not only has she left her phone, but somebody saw the whole thing go down, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And ran off, so there's a lot to be determined.
I did watch the most recent episode. It aired on Sunday. So I'm even caught up on that.
Do I need to, I won't even ask questions. I was going to say.
Are you going to ask if you should take anxiety medicine before you
watch? Yeah, that was kind of be the gist of what I asked. Should I wait until the coffee wears off so I'm not quite as jittery when I watch it? But
It has a few moments. It's not as heightened.
I don't know how it could be.
Yeah, exactly.
It went from breezy to death real quick. So I'm enjoying it, though.
Yeah, for sure. It's pretty good. I think it's a bit of a roller coaster. I think that, and I mean that in quality, that at times it could be better, but it's not. So, but it like you mentioned, fairly breezy, and then you get your big episode of Manslaughter, and we'll see what happens from here.
Yeah.
The other show, Twitter length sort of response, is one that you mentioned to me, and I decided I would check it out as well, was The Great on Hulu, basically a very anachronistic view of Catherine the Great.
Pretty good.
Here's my, okay, so I kind of do have maybe even a Twitter length review, because I've only watched one episode. How about you?
We're like probably five in.
Oh, wow. Okay, so here was, I watched one episode, and this is my take. I just love how it says, this seems to be a takedown of bro culture and is social commentary on the 1%.
That's it. I'm pretty sure we could tweet that no matter what era of Twitter we were in.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the consistent theme. There's
good. I'm glad it doesn't drop that theme, because that's what's got me hooked. I want to see exactly how much this writer and director dissects and chops up those bastards.
Yeah, it's all there. It's a multi-pronged kind of idea, because, you know, she can come off as cold or even arrogant. I mean, they're all arrogant, deeply arrogant, but you know, how she has to navigate learning how to treat other people to kind of get them on her side, all those kind of elements. So it's good. It's funny. We started watching that, and I started the podcast that I mentioned earlier, which is about the fall of the Soviet Union. And I'm kind of inundated with Russian stuff right now. I don't know what's going on. I literally today finished a day in the life of Ivan Denisovich. So this is, I'm just out in the tundra right now.
You're steeped in Russian mythology.
I love that play on words there. Steeped in it.
Mm-hmm.
The program's good. I don't know that it's great, but it's pretty enjoyable.
Despite its title, it may not be great.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, well. Yeah,
I'll take it. I'll take it.
I think I'll watch one episode, and I'm eager to watch more. That's for sure. So let's move into The Last Dance. It aired episodes 9 and 10. The last two episodes aired last night. We record on Monday, as everyone probably knows by now. Give me your overall generalized thoughts, and we can start picking apart episodes 9 and 10 of the Michael Jordan documentary.
Are we zooming all the way out? What did I think about the whole thing, or just about these episodes?
Totally up to you, man.
Well, I've been wrestling.
Clear the lane, and you drive the basket.
I've been wrestling with how I feel about the whole thing, pretty much the whole time.
Why?
Well, we've talked about this a bit, that it has been stellar television, very enjoyable to watch, especially in the climate that it was put out in. Like, I don't think we can ever, even 10 years from now, forget that these ten episodes came out across the 5 weeks that were really the heart of the quarantine, and especially that first week, how that was the first time that it felt like all of us were watching the same thing at the same time, that wasn't like a terrible presidential news briefing or CNN or whatever, like that actually brought joy to people. Kind of the thing that we lost when sports went away, or when we can't all go see the same movie over the same weekend right now, all those kind of things. So all of that's really important. But once you kind of zoom back, it's like, did they really say anything about anybody in this that we didn't already know? Like, ultimately, it is a Michael Jordan approved version of his career.
So as it turns out, you kind of do agree with Ken Burns.
I don't have a problem with it. I'm just saying, you do have to wonder, because I'm going to watch it again. If this was on, I would definitely watch. And I thought it was great all along. I'm just wondering about the long term. Is there more that you want to know about that era? Like, I still feel like there's probably a great 90s Bulls documentary to be made that didn't get his seal of approval. You know what I mean? There's probably still a lot of interesting stories to tell. I do think that it was at its strongest when it was early on, like the episode about Jordan's ascension, and then the episode about Pippen, and then the episode about Rodman, and then you learn Phil's backstory. Even this last week, you got Steve Kerr's backstory. Mm-hmm. So all of those things were very well done. You just wonder, I mean, maybe that's part of what's charming about it. You know, there was a line about, I can't remember which reporter said, Jordan achieved levels of fame that are maybe still unmatched by sports figures. And he did it in an era without social media. And I just had to think that that benefited him, you know, like both on the level of you kind of joke about athletes of the past or entertainers of the past couldn't get away with what they got away with just because the lights never turn off now. But some of him being a mystery and just seeming like magic when he hit those shots or when he did there were no videos of him every day just like shooting baskets at the gym. You know what I mean? Like it was all just mythical from day one.
The show was worth it if only for two things. And that was all those fantastic highlights and all those expressions from Jordan that he got from watching his peers talk about him.
Yeah, that was great. Those were... But even that, you know, the choice was made to interview everybody else and then give him the benefit of reaction.
Yeah, that was a good choice, I think, made for entertaining television.
It did, and that's the whole point. Like, this is the ESPN production, Michael Jordan approved bag of potato chips, you know? And like, it was awesome. I loved it. I was sad when it ended. I think it did a great job of capturing the spirit of all of everything that it showed. It wasn't really investigative. I mean, it had moments of emotional depth, like when his dad passes away, or the security guard in this last episode, you know, moments when he or any of them had like emotional connections outside the realm of maybe what we saw at the time. But I don't know. It's still like, is this heavy hitting on the level that maybe some of the other 30 for 30s are?
Yeah, I think that's what you and I are pushing up against, is that it was not investigative. It was just a document.
A celebration, which is fine.
Yeah, a celebration is an even better word, I think. I'm glad Steve Kerr got his moment, because I had heard a few things about his dad and him, and I'm glad that got on screen. Apparently, his dad is really still renowned in the Middle East for his working over there.
That was supposedly I say supposedly because I'm doubting my own knowledge, not the people that I've read it from, kind of like a foundational text for Westerners understanding
exactly
the Middle East in the era that he was writing and working. So there's times when, you know, as much as I hate the Warriors, it's impossible to hate Steve Kerr all along.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at his Twitter account or his interviews, he says what he thinks, and it's usually well measured. And seeing that background for him, it's those people who say, "Oh, just shut up and coach. What do you know about this?" It's like, well, you know, he's actually got blood in the game, so to speak. I mean, it's all personal to mm-hmm. him.
From what I understand, his mother is still pretty involved with those kinds of political issues too.
Yeah, she was a professor herself, right? After the family kind of grew up. But I don't know. I thought the whole production was endlessly enjoyable. Like, if I'm only rating how much I enjoyed it, it's kind of like we were talking about with Stephen Hyden last week. If you are only rating this as a consumer, A+, right? But if you're trying to be kind of objective and like, what are they really trying to say? Maybe it slips a little bit.
Yeah,
but for me, A+.
I agree. And a lot of respect to Steve Kerr, like you were saying. And that's not just because someone thought I was Steve Kerr in Savannah, Georgia once.
I could see it.
No, Steve Kerr's awesome. I wish he didn't coach the Warriors, but, you know, it's fine. Okay, so I thoroughly enjoyed The Last Dance. I was going to say any other comments, but I do want to make a comment. I was pretty disappointed that they never gave us, they didn't tack on anything at the end about his Wizard days. Granted, I know the show was not about his days with the Wizards when he came back again, but the reason it was just sort of a selfish thing for me, I wanted that to be on screen and documented, because I forgot a lot of what happened when he came back, and because it just got, it got shuffled, swept under the rug, I suppose might be the phrase I could use. Anyway, I have completely forgotten all of his wizards stuff. Did you remember any of that?
Well, only because that was, yeah, I was pretty young during his rise in total dominance, right? So like the wizards was like, oh, I'll get my chance to see him be that. And he wasn't, you know, it was always like, I was aware even as a, I don't know when he finally retired. You know what year, 2003, maybe 2002?
I don't remember.
And anyway, knowing that I was watching like a shell of what was. So that was a bummer. That the exclusion of that kind of reminded me of, have you seen the Oasis documentary, Supersonic?
No, I haven't.
It ends at when they play at Nebworth, which is like, if you ask them, that is the, there are two shows I think that they would point to. One's the Main Road show, which is where, Main Road is the stadium that Manchester City played in. So this would be like an Alabama-based band selling out Bryant Denny Stadium. You know what I mean? This was just like the biggest deal to them. And then Nebworth was the next, a few years later, kind of when they were really at their mid to late 90s peak. And then the documentary ends. They show like the beginnings of Oasis, the formation, the brothers, all this stuff. And then it ends at the high point. And Jordan chose to do the exact same thing, which it makes sense because that is the era that's being celebrated. And kind of, I don't know, all the stories about Phil bringing him in and them writing what being on that team had meant to each other and then burning it was such a fitting way to do that. And there's always a feeling of sadness. I even wondered this, if they think, all right, game six, we're probably going to win this game. How heavy is that on them that this is the last time that they're playing together? You know, they know there's no like questions about it. They know this is it. I don't know. There's always a sadness to that.
Yeah, I agree. Do you think that his time with, and this might be common knowledge, again, it's lost in my memory. He went back and rejoined a club, the Wizards. Did that tarnish his legacy, you think?
I thought about this a lot, actually, because yeah, him retiring twice, you just wonder, like, what could he have done had he stayed that year and a half in Chicago instead of going to play baseball? What could he have done? I mean, it sounds like he's still haunted by, could he have won seven if they had signed everybody to one-year contracts and gone for it that next year? But there's that segment in this one, maybe the most interesting personality glimpse, when they talk about he was the ultimate, like, in-the-moment Zen master. I don't think that you would think that from him insulting his teammates and all these other things, that it's very becoming of like a spiritual mystic. They call him a mystic, something like that. But it's a very Phil Jackson thing of like, we're here right now. You can only make your decision based on right now. Like, I don't think that he saw his accomplishments as a career's worth, but I don't think he saw the journey as linear. You know what I mean? Because it was only happening right now. He wanted to accomplish all these things, but like, to me, it doesn't make sense, because one thing is A is supposed to lead to B to C to D in a superstar's life, right? Like, we want to watch the movie where it all kind of plays out. Like, you wanted him to hit that last shot in game five and win it at home in Chicago on the last second shot. Like, that would have been a truly fitting Jordan moment, but he didn't get it. He had to go win in Utah. So the fact that he kind of followed his whims, I mean, you wonder if he had stayed, and you can't imagine him floundering at basketball, but if he still hadn't emotionally gotten over what happened to his dad and he had to kind of zombie through a season, would that tarnish his legacy? I don't know. Like, if he just had a totally aloof season, which would be totally understandable in the situation, but I think about that. What do you think? Does it tarnish it that he finished in a Wizards uniform?
I'm always disappointed when an athlete doesn't get to finish his or her career with the team that brought them to a legendary status, if they've achieved that. I'm always saddened by that, deeply.
I'm with you. So does it bugs you, like, if we play football this upcoming season it bugs you that Tom Brady is going to be playing in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I hate Tom Brady, but it's got to be. I'm sorry, what?
Objectively, you know, like I dislike him as well, but just thinking about.
No, it's sad. Yes, it's just it's sad. It's weird. It doesn't fit in the box that my brain wants it to have. Just like I'll give you an example. Robert Parrish from the Boston Celtics in the 80s, he went on to play with the Chicago Bulls. And that was just sad that he didn't retire when Bird and McHale retired, who they got to do their whole career with the Celtics. Well, McHale didn't, but Bird got to do his whole career with the Celtics.
Especially organizations like Celtics or the Lakers, or, you know, even if you want to include our more familiar turf like Alabama or other bigger SEC or Big Ten schools, whatever, it's like, well, why would you not? I guess that applies more to coaches because the players are only there for a certain amount of time. But, you know, like if Saban like went somewhere else now, it's like, why? What's the point?
And in that case, it's not going to tarnish anyone's legacy. But for Jordan, he comes back and has, I'm assuming, again, this is, my memory is fuzzy during this period for reasons, but it seems as though he came back to a very lackluster performance.
Yeah, I mean, how could you, that was one of the best teams ever, you know? I mean, you could argue that in terms of how they assembled it, and this is another interesting thing about the doc, that they spent all of that time ragging on the front office and then kind of like try to make amends in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, they sort of do, don't they?
That he was such an important piece to everything. And they touch a bit on this with Steve Kerr when he talks about learning what it meant to be a role player, mm-hmm. into being the ultimate role player around, I mean, what fraction of the top 1% of basketball players in the world do you have to be to make the NBA? And then to get there, and for Michael Jordan or whoever it is, now I guess it'd be LeBron, all these Kawhi Leonard, these people to be that much better than you, that you have to like mold your game around them. How can I help them win? Those were interesting bits, I thought.
Yeah, very much.
But the Bulls, them getting those perfect ingredients, I don't know that could have been replicated in any other time or era.
Two quick questions. You have thoughts on Rodman ditching practice to go wrestle?
I thought that for such a hardline dude as Jordan was, he just seemed to accept that, and it kind of drives me crazy when people are like, well, I just got to do what I got to do, you know what I mean? It's like, well, I mean, I guess he did show up and was a dominant defensive player when they asked him to do that, but I don't know, that would have driven me absolutely insane. It's kind of awesome, and as a consumer, it's awesome, but man, I don't know how the team stomached that.
Yeah, I guess because they couldn't go without him, you know.
That would make me so mad, because it's like you're being held hostage by your teammate in some ways, you know, by his whims.
For sure. I think that's Rodman in a nutshell in his latter years.
Yeah.
I did love the moment where Bird had become the coach and he meets Jordan in the outside the locker room. Yeah.
After the game. And after they talk trash.
Yeah, they still talk a little trash, but in a very friendly way. Yeah, that was a great moment. It's a credit to the filmmaker and the director there that he was able, and most good documentaries will do this, they're able to squeeze tension out of things that you already know have happened and you already know the result of.
Yeah, it is. And maybe there's some good fortune in all of these playoff series, at least being best of seven. So there are outcomes to certain games that maybe you don't remember.
Right. So
they can build tension there. It's not like football, kind of one and done, kind of where you probably remember most of the beats of major games. But but no, you're right. Still wishing that something wouldn't happen, or anxious that he's not going to hit the shot, or even like the shot. You know what I mean? It's still, like you said, a credit to them.
Yeah, they tell you in the opening episode what they're examining, and the fact that they've won six championships, so there's no doubt that he's going to win the game, or one of those games.
Tell you that they don't play a game seven in the finals.
Yeah, but they still managed to milk some excitement out of those scenes. So it's good stuff. Definitely entertaining. I'm glad we got it, and you know, it made for good conversation as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and it just brought people. They kind of got a little meta at the end to me when the president of the Bulls talked about just being honored to have been a part. You know, when they had those big celebrations in Grant Park in the summer after the championship, and he saw all those smiling faces, how happy they were, being a small part of bringing people joy. And I think that's definitely what the show, not to get all cheesy, but I mean, you know, for 2 hours every week, I kind of forgot about COVID or whatever else was going on. And my whole Twitter timeline switched to this, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. All right. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. We hope that you subscribe, give us a rating, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and your other podcast providers. And here's what we'll do. We'll be back next Tuesday, and we'll be talking maybe a little bit of Hulu's television show, The Great. We might talk a little bit of the HBO show starring Mark Ruffalo. So we'll give our thoughts on various other things next week. It's going to be all new because we're done with Normal People, and we're done with The Last Dance, and we've enjoyed it. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next Tuesday.